I'm watching.
Yes, but like here, you say your fear is if you become totally intimate with me, that you will, of necessity, be incompetent in the world. That somehow those two are mutually exclusive. And so you're dooming yourself to failure in the world by choosing in true, relaxed intimacy. And so when we start to talk about intimacy, yes, please.
Could we have milk with the coffee instead of cream?
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So we start to talk about how we could get more intimate, and immediately you say, I want to help the victims of the world. And so for a while I don't understand what that has to do with us being more intimate, and finally it comes out that what that has to do with is that that's the expression of your fear. So then you tell me, you should let me express the fear to you.
Morning.
Hello.
Hi. Would you like another few minutes to look at the menu?
No, I know exactly what I want. Smoked salmon and bagel and cream cheese.
Certainly.
And what kind of fresh berries do you have?
We have strawberries today, and I believe we have blueberries as well.
I don't think I'm going to get any berries, actually.
All right, the La Pli Spa Cuisine, whole grapefruit, homemade granola, low-fat yogurt, clam muffins, skim milk, and coffee.
All of the above.
All
right.
Of the above.
And could we get a pot of coffee or something?
Certain.
Thanks.
Is regular coffee?
Yeah.
All right.
So then you say, let me express my fear. So what does it mean to express your fear? Let me give you the list of all the people who I want to help, the victims of the world. And you started on your list. Some of those people I like, some of those people I don't like. And the list is long. And I can think of some people you left off the list. But I don't want to add to the length of your list. I figure that's all right. Now, here's the question. I hear the end of your list. That is the expression of your fear. Does that dissipate your fear? Is that the point where I can relax and say, now he's going to be intimate with me? Or do I have to somehow deal with you on the substantive issue of all the victims?
I think that the answer is no, you don't have to deal with me on the substantive issues.
Not that I don't want to, I just want to know.
I think the answer is no. First of all, I am expressing a fear, but what is the fear I'm expressing? It's not the fear that I won't be successful in the world. That's not the fear.
I misinterpreted your fear?
A little bit.
Yeah.
My fear is that I'll lose touch with my commitment to my father. And it's my basic...
That's what's behind your
line
fear
of division.
Being,
okay. That's right. Is between mother and father.
And that's right. You're not scared that you'd be incompetent. You know you're competent.
I know that I can do loads of things.
You're scared that you will no longer be loving to your father.
My father is the animal in the road.
I understand. He's the black people. He's the whole thing.
He needs my help.
I understand. So what you're not saying, if you choose to be intimate with a woman, you're necessarily going to become incompetent. You say, if you choose to be intimate with a woman, you're necessarily not going to be intimate with a man.
I'm afraid that I will be captured by my mother.
Who didn't want you to be intimate with your father.
Who was in competition with my father.
Of course.
And...
Of course. Well, okay. And that makes it different my response to you different, because when I tell you, don't worry, I want you to be competent in the world, that can't satisfy you.
Right.
So I've got to be able to say, I want you to have relationships with other people. And here's where my problem comes in. I don't mind. I have a hard time with your wanting to have relationships with victims. Because a lot of the victims that you choose are people who I feel have victimized themselves and have chosen to be weak. So I don't respect them. You know, like I endorse your relationship with the kids, and it's in a sense they're weaker people, but they're awfully strong, and they go for strength, and they move towards strength, and I respect them, and I endorse your relationship with your friends. I endorse your relationship with people like Ogletree and Greg, and people you choose to have as friends. I find they're very strong people. They're admirable people. I think it's wonderful. I have a harder time. I endorse your friendship with Chester. I mean, there's somebody who needs help, but he's not self-pitying. He knows what he needs help in, and when he doesn't need help, he offers. Right? I just have trouble because you tend to get your list of victims together, and they're of course, naturally, quite like your father, a person who dug his own grave.
But what is a weak person? Other than someone who has been overpowered by very strong forces. I think weakness is something that people have been taught, and they were taught their weakness at times when they didn't have the power or the knowledge to resist. They were overwhelmed by forces they didn't understand.
But you and I had overwhelming forces in our life. Very strong parents operating toward the negative a whole lot of time. And we couldn't make it completely, but we chose to keep fighting. Now, how do you distinguish between that and people who choose not to?
Because with both of us, notwithstanding the troubles, there was balance in our lives. I, for all of the problems, was balanced between my mother and my father.
I was not. I was dropped between the two of them, flat to the ground.
I think you're right.
But I did have some other people. I got my balance other places.
You did. And even as between your mother and your father, it's what's emerged so strongly in the last couple of months is that your father was a key player in it.
Right.
And you felt dropped by both of them.
Absolutely. That's what I just said.
Imbalanced by both of them, captured by neither of them.
So you're saying that it's purely outside forces that dictate your how much strength of character you possess and how much you use. And I don't believe that. It's all right. I mean, it doesn't make any difference who wins that argument, but I don't believe it.
Well, I actually think it does make a difference. And I don't mean it as a scientific proposition. It's irrelevant to me to engage it as a scientific proposition. But as a proposition, as a hypothesis about life, I can't see my hypothesis disproved. I don't see it disproved because any person that you show me who seems inherently weak, I think you can go back early enough and find the overwhelming experiences. And
but
so,
you can find them.
But wait, so what's important out of that is that you approach every person with, as a teacher, you approach every person with the idea that this person can learn to be a stronger person if you can simply help the person clarify the fear and find the point of choice and then encourage the person with affirmative expectation to make the positive choice.
Right, but and I see, I know you believe that, and I believe that. That's the way I act with my friends. But I have, in the end, very little tolerance for people who wallow. And so most of my friends are fairly strong people.
Right.
I wouldn't choose to be friends with John Mansfield.
Right. But I see in each of those people, you take Ellen and John Mansfield, I see in each one of them, more in John than Ellen right now.
I like John better than I like Ellen. I like John. That's not a problem.
But I see in each one of them a desire to grow.
She has, you don't see one bit of desire in her to grow. So just...
It's true that so far I have not had an easy time seeing it.
Charlie, you're just being stupid on
it. I know, don't put me down.
I'm not putting you down.
I think that I can see the desire to grow in Ellen, in her house. I think that I see it, actually I see it in lots of things with her. She's got a tremendously strong desire to be a real person competently functioning in the world.
Absolutely true.
And that for her represented growth from where she felt she was.
Absolutely right.
Right. And her problem is that she hasn't set a very elevated goal for herself.
Right.
She set that as her goal, and she is proud, enormously proud that she accomplished it.
But she's hanging on to that by her fingernails and won't move. Now, if I did that, this is what bugs me about you. If I set a goal for myself that low and did only that and fought any of your attempts to get broader in any way, you would have nothing more to do with me.
No.
But with the victims of the world...
No, that's wrong. I would not. When that happens with you and me, whether it's you to me or me to you, the way we relate is we fight each other. We show the other person. I show you that I love you, but I don't respect that. And every time you give me a rationalization for why you should settle, I kick the shit out of it.
Okay, but if you had met me when I had accomplished my goal of becoming a competent person and having a job and working, you never, and that was it, and you said, want to be smart? Want to be interested in other things? Want to have children? Want to travel? Want to talk about things? And I said, no, absolutely not. What I want to do is get my paycheck and come home. Would you have married me?
No, but
all don't go that, no but so fast.
Yeah, no. The no is absolutely clear. I wouldn't have fallen in love with you. I'm not in love with Ellen. I'm not in love with John Mansfield. I picked you
but
out.
But you think he's cute.
I picked you out because, and you picked me out because we match.
Right.
In terms of our life force.
We're always setting new goals.
We match. Now, I wouldn't be at all surprised if there are people who have stronger life force than we do. Or at least did back at the age that we were at. They were people that scared me.
Right.
But I found in you someone who matched my life force and who made my life real.
I understand.
And it wasn't as if we matched so perfectly that neither of us grew. We matched in ways that...
We matched in having the same goal.
We matched in having the same force.
So that's the same thing, what
right.
I'm saying.
That's right.
We had the same goal, which was not to sit still.
Right.
Not to say, this is as far as we've advanced, and now let's stop. This is good. Let's stay here.
We could reciprocate. Right.
All right, but this is what I've always said. People say, what'd you see in Charlie? I said, I saw that he would push me to keep growing. Right?
Right.
Now, the...
And I saw the same thing in you.
I'm sure. But what I don't understand...
You were going to push me to keep growing by being... more and more honest with feelings.
More intimate. Thank you.
Thanks.
You're welcome. Can I bring you anything else right now?
No, that's just fine. You all set for it?
A little more milk for the coffee.
Sure.
Thanks.
Thank you.
All right, but I don't... let's get back to the list of the victims. I have some more questions. What? Well, I guess I don't remember questions about the list of the victims, but I do remember the question about what.
You were asking me how.
What
do
I do when I get the list?
Right.
Yeah.
And what I'm saying is something like this. In that situation that we had this morning, it became clear that you had pushed through a big fear that you had with me. That is, I had accompanied you on your fight. And it's as if we had been in the fight together, and we fought through to a success.
You mean the heart rate stuff?
The heart rate and the fears that were associated with it.
Right.
And so we became comrades in arms. And it pushed us to a new level of intimacy. And you expressed your new energy that you no longer had to put into that fear in the form of willingness to love me more.
Right.
You open yourself up to the love, and it then brought us into touch with a fear of mine.
Which you roundly denied.
That's the first stage of that denial. I'm going to ward it off. But when you started loving me, you gave up a control mechanism over me.
Right.
That was very powerful. And important.
And was protecting you too.
That's correct. It's exactly what I was going to say. Important to both of us in maintaining the orbits that we were in.
Mm-hmm.
And when you lost that, you felt extremely anxious.
Mm-hmm.
And insecure.
Very. Panicked.
Panicked. And you respond to the panic by expressing your fear of being dropped, being left alone, the whole.
I got this overwhelming feeling that my life with you was so precious that I didn't want to spend 1 minute doing anything else, insofar as it was possible for the rest of the summer. I just wanted to remember this time for the rest of my life, to have it be intimate and wonderful and sexy and exciting and alone. And I just thought, if I'm going to have to die and someday not see this man ever again, I just want it to be wonderful now.
Right. And that starts to resonate with a fundamental fear of mine.
Could have at least taken 2 seconds to be flattered.
Right. Well, I did, actually.
Actually, I did.
I did. I mean, I could see the joy in it. There was the joy in it before there was the fear. I mean, I got a rush that was unbelievable.
Yeah?
Yeah. Absolutely. And then it frightened me.
Uh-huh.
And as we've talked, it's clear to me what the fright is. The fright is the fear that I'll be captured by you in some way, that I'll get drawn into the world of intimacy with you in a way that will...
You'll have to say goodbye to your father.
Make me say goodbye to my father, and will show me that I am not competent to help him, that I'm not competent even to satisfy you. I mean, the fears that are in there are fears of impotence. They're fears of being exhausted, of not being able to get it up, of not being able to stay honest with you.
Is that why you had to go exercise, that your body was weak, and then you went out and exercised, and came back and you said, I felt real good?
Probably. And so I go from being in a state of comrade in arms with you in a fight where we're focused on a goal and we're...
You don't mean in a fight against each other.
Not in a fight against
in
each other.
A common battle.
A common battle. But we're both fighting. As we're both energized and focused and moving. I go from that state, to the state of repose in which we both are enjoying the fruits of victory.
And why should we do that?
And then, in the course of enjoying the fruits of victory, I start to feel anxiety on my part. And the anxiety on my part leads me into a state of feeling vigilant and then threatened. Threatened? I guess the threat comes first. The feeling of threat comes first. It puts me in the state of vigilance. And then the question becomes, how do I deal with that? Do I go into a mode in which you and I fight as comrades in arms towards a goal that's mine in the same way that we were fighting?
That seems reasonable, doesn't it?
It seems wonderful. Or do we go into a mode in which you and I are fighting against each other, where I see you as the enemy and I flee you? Are we fighting as comrades, or am I fleeing you? It's fight or flight. And what we've been talking about is the logic of that situation. It's a situation in which I feel a want and a need. And I'm in the situation of well, this morning when I talked to you and we saw this control aspect of the sexual relationship and how it played out between us. And I then felt this need right away. I mean, I could see that you understood the control part of it.
Right.
And I felt this need right away to tell you about my fear, about the list.
Yes, and I didn't understand you telling me about your fear.
Right. And I think that what's going on is that the fear, in my mind, is unreal. As it's real in internal senses, but there's no outside real-world threat to me. It's not like hunger or a bullet wound or something. And if I can express my fear to you, the fear will express itself. The need, I will express myself. And if I have a need, that need will express itself. And the need that I'm feeling is a need to deal with this fear. So if I can express myself to you, and you can relate to it as something that's in my mind, that is, that's not an action thing in the world, but is a fear. And you can listen to my fear, let me say it to you fully, so I've fully expressed it, and then let me know that I've fully expressed it by resonating it back to me in a way that shows me empathy, that is, by responding to it not as an action proposition,
yeah,
but simply as a state of mind. I have this state of mind.
If I were to say to you, what I hear you saying to me, Charlie, is that you're scared by a further degree of intimacy because you feel you will lose contact with your father. I know that if you said something to me that was sort of a psychological interpretation of some, you know, if I was saying to you, I have to get out of this movie theater right now. I can't stand this movie. And if you turned to me and said, what I hear you saying is you're fearing drowning, I'd hit you. Do you see what I'm saying? I'm afraid that if I were to come back to you on, you know, a sort of supercilious psychological interpretation of what you're saying, that you would say, no, what I'm saying is I haven't had one day this summer when I can have lunch with John Mansfield.
Yeah, but I'm not saying that, I don't think. I see what you're saying. If you're in the movie theater and you say to me, I'm feeling claustrophobic.
Right.
And I sit there in the movie theater with you and say, let's discuss your claustrophobia.
Right.
You might well say to me,
outside, the appropriate response is,
come on, let's get out of the movie
theater.
Right. Now, it just may be that the appropriate response is to sit in the movie theater for as long as you can stand it.
And when I said to you, why don't you call John Mansfield and have lunch with him today, you said yes. I mean, you wanted a response on the action front, too.
That's true, too.
That's why I keep asking
what I really wanted mm-hmm. up in bed when we were mm-hmm. first talking mm-hmm. about it was I didn't want to jump out of bed right away.
I didn't understand.
That isn't what
okay.
I wanted.
I didn't understand.
I'm thinking of, we got 2 days, and I was proposing to you some way in which you could organize the future so I could include in it the vacation intimate time with you and the time to do my other mishigas.
Mm-hmm.
But I wasn't looking for the immediate out right at that moment.
I see. Okay.
All right, so what I'm saying to you, when you say to me in the movie theater, I'm feeling claustrophobic, I'm feeling suffocated, I'm feeling like I've got to get out of here. One way of our handling that situation might actually be for me to respond to you in a way that lets you know that I understand your state of mind. Not just that I'm going to respond to it, but that I actually understand it. I might, if I were to say back to you, although I'm not feeling claustrophobic myself, I can certainly see how you would.
Mm-hmm.
I can see the things in this environment that would make you feel the same way that I feel when I'm being feeling hemmed in
mm-hmm.
to the point where I feel I have to give up connections with
victims of the world.
Victims of the world, right.
Did you remember to bring your wallet?
Yeah, it's in the bag, I think. Oh, no, I don't think I did. I'll have to go down to the car and get it.
That's what I was worried about.
Yeah. All right. I may have a credit card in the bag.
What?
And the interesting thing about that is that if I succeed in empathizing with your fear, and you see that it's like my fear, you may realize that your fear is in fact like my fear, that it's imaginary, that you don't necessarily have to act it out by getting up and going out of the movie theater.
Right.
That you may in fact be able to deal with it by going through it in some way. Saying, oh, here, let me actually look again at what the things are in this theater that are making me uncomfortable. And look at them one by one and see that, in fact, they're not so fearsome, that the dangers that you fear are lurking in the theater aren't really there, that they're in your mind and that they come from some prior fear story.
Right.
And we might get through it that way. Now, I think that there's a logic of persuasion in that. I think that says that if you're relating to somebody that you have to see that there's a dark side for them. If they're in indecision, that means that there's a fear.
Absolutely.
And you have to find out what the fear is.
This is what I told you with Eric. When Eric wrote you that letter and said, I can't participate in a project in which you have the control, because my fear is that I'm always got my father in control of me and I have to be an independent person, that the way to deal with him and retain the friendship and retain the working relationship was to first acknowledge his fear and to say, for you, you're absolutely right. There is a dark side of this for you. But if we both see the dark side, then we can choose to see it as unreal in this situation.
I think the first step is absolutely right, but the second step, I'm not sure. It may go too fast, because the second step has got to be to see the dark side, but to let the other person know that you see it so clearly. In fact, in a way more clearly than the other person sees it. That is, for the person that has the fear, they're in indecision.
Right.
They are actually in indecision. That means that there's a countervailing force that's bringing them back the other way.
Right.
When you see their fear, you can see it in a way that leaves out the countervailing force. So that as you relate it to them, you can see it so clearly that the decision is clear on the fear side. And that's what gives them the power to say, no, I've got to turn my focus to the other side of the force. Do you see what I'm saying? That's what I mean by empathizing with the fear in a way that, in fact,
states it
more clearly than the person.
Because if you take that situation with Eric, for example, you had an interest in having him participate. You advanced the positive side to him. Then he advanced the negative side to you. If you see the positive side, they know you're nuts.
No, but that isn't what you advised me to do with Eric. The steps that you advised me to do with Eric and that were so elegant in their execution, I mean, it was like a hypothesis that proved itself. You analyzed the situation. You saw the dark side for Eric. You said to me, call Eric. Start out by restating his argument from his point of view and show him that you understand it completely from his point of view.
And that you agree with it from your point of view. Go on.
Recognize that what he was trying to do was offer a compromise that would mush up the clarity of the choice and make you give in. Make it clear to him that from his point of view, it was a completely understandable vision of the problem. And you could see that from his point of view, the only solution was for me to give in.
Right.
Then make it clear to him that I didn't want to give in. I wasn't going to give in. That I loved him, that I wanted to continue the friendship, that I thought that the best way to continue the friendship was to be clear in the choice and for each of us to make choices that were right for us in the situation. And that the right choice for me in that situation was to stick with my original goal and not compromise it. And I could see that from his point of view, it was the right choice for him to pull away from it.
Right.
Right. As soon as I did that, then he was open. I'd done it lovingly at that point,
right.
So he had a free choice.
Right.
As soon as I did that, he was able to start looking for the positive things. And in fact, we found them almost immediately.
It's
a short term, it's this. I mean, it would be a great learning experience. I can see it. And bang, it was over.
Well, you gave him the free choice. And by giving him the free choice, you said, it's true, I'm retaining control of the project, but I'm not acting like your father because I'm not insisting that you stay in the family.
That's correct. It's your choice. That's your truth. I see the dark side. I see it so clearly that I can agree with your choice.
See,
and I don't feel bad about it. It's a right choice for you. And at that point, he's ready to say, well, maybe it's not a right choice for me. Now that I'm free, I can make a choice that's right for both of us.
That's what I think. You let him out.
Right.
And then you weren't his father because you weren't in control. If you were in control, you would have said, it's the wrong choice, or you would have said, this isn't good for you, or you would have said, I'm letting you out, but I'm going to be mad. Right?
Right, exactly right. And in fact, what I was saying was, I'm going to let you out, but we're going to be friends.
Right. Because I respect your choice.
I respect your choice.
Before you read to me from Richard Parker, I want to ask you something that's been bugging me now for over a week. It's just one question, and I hope you'll say yes. Could we go to your father's grave?
Sure.
I would like to do it.
Okay, sure. Do you have some theory in mind of what's going to happen?
None.
Just an instinct.
I've asked you that a week ago, and you said no.
Sure, Kim.
I don't have a theory or an instinct, but my feeling is the last person that I would want you to lose contact with is your father.
Right.
And in fact, I can't stand your mother.
Mm. All right.
Would you like more coffee?
Yes, please. And I want you to understand what side I stand on this thing is not on your mother's side, and I don't like being lumped there.
I do, I understand that.
I want you to understand it in your heart.
In fact, you are much more like my father than you are like my mother.
No kidding.
In many, many, many ways. Your sense of quality, and of style, your Jewishness, your emotion. I mean, with all of my father being Silent Sam,
he was also an actor.
He was the one who would let it out.
Yeah. See, what I didn't like about your mother was that she was an extremely competitive person, but she tried to hide it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she just tried to stand in the background and dress beautifully, and she would think she would win it, cook a nice meal.
Mm-hmm.
But all the time she was fighting,
uh-huh.
It was just dishonest. This is sort of what I felt Ivy did this morning when she called at 7 o'clock. Basically, she was saying, Charlie, now your relationship is with me. I hope you're in bed with Fern, and I hope I'm interrupting you.
She had some agenda. We didn't figure out what it was.
My rent control. And I did something that you'll be proud of. She asked me this question of this rent control thing and her friend in Cambridge and the house and all this stuff. And I said, Ivy, this is very complicated and I don't know the answer to any of this. What I think your friend needs is a lawyer. And she said, that's what I told her. So I said, you gave very good advice. You're a pretty smart person, Ivy. And then where was she going to go from there? So she laughed, and she said, I did think it was kind of common sense, so I said, you're absolutely right. Can I go now? But she wouldn't let me off. She kept saying, so you don't know anything about this? You don't know anything about this? And I said, none, nothing. And then she said, well, do you know of a lawyer? And I said, no, actually. I have no idea. So, Richard Parker.
Well, first let me describe. The beginning of it. Richard was anxious to begin. His biggest worry was that he wouldn't have enough time to say what he wanted to say. He had something to say, and he wanted the time to say it. So that when it became quarter of one, which is the beginning time, and Dick Stewart wasn't paying attention, Stewart having the job of beginning it.
Also, Stewart never paying attention.
Richard taps the glass and gets it going. Turns to Stewart and says, I'm beginning. You know? He starts off talking about the two worlds, polar oppositions, two different sensibilities that he represents by light and dark. And states his thesis that we tend too much to deny the dark side. Light for him means coherence, clarity, order. We see reality in the light.
And that's what you believe, isn't it?
Yes.
And you think that you're the optimist and I'm the pessimist, and I've always felt that Richard and I agree on this.
Yes. Yes. We want reality.
Some of us could care less.
In the light world, we quest for connection and resolution. The light world is optimism, spirit, progress, and growth. On the dark side, we imagine the dark side in the night.
Well, we meet the absurdity of our condition. We know we're going to die. We know that we're striving, and it's all going to end in worms.
The dark side, incoherent, obscure. We experience it as intense, uncertain, distorted, threatening. What's at work on the dark side seems to be the raw brute forces inside us and raw brute forces outside us, the forces of criminality, of hate, of Hitler, of all of that.
Let me just say death.
Death. With no push toward resolution, but a drive towards anxiety. And Richard's describing this, and you begin to feel the passion rising in him. I mean, you see right away.
I love the way Richard argues, because he gets his emotion in it always.
Always, always.
He's always arguing on the edge of tears.
There's true passion in it.
Right.
It's himself that he's describing. He describes the dark side as producing this state of anxiety, which for him is expressed as a state of defiance and vigilance. That's the way he sees it. Now we're beginning to get Richard's rationalization of himself with that. And he's trying to see the plus.
Well, that does speak directly about Richard, because Richard believes there's always a conspiracy. If you look hard enough, you'll find the evil conspiracy behind every move.
Right.
That's funny, because I saw a picture of his father. He has a picture of his father in his office, and you should go look at it. Because his father looks like a handsomer, even handsomer version of Richard. It's a picture of his father, young, a lot of black hair, you know. Very handsome, thin, angular. He doesn't look at all like the light side. Not at all. He looks like James Agee. You know what James Agee looked like?
Yeah.
Go look at the picture.
I will.
It's so interesting because it doesn't look like this guy in the cheerful. Fascinating picture. I love the picture. You could fall in love with Richard's father just looking at the picture.
Okay. Then Richard says that he has drawn a lot of his thought from film noir. He's a student of film noir.
He must love the movie Breathless.
The movies he mentioned, I didn't note them down. He said that the film noir period began in 1941 with Maltese Falcon and ended in 1958 with a movie the name of which I missed. And what he meant by that, and this came clear later in the questions, was its existence as a dominant genre. Not that film noir has dropped out of existence. It's now reflected and echoed in many, many films. It's a tremendously powerful influence on our thought.
Right.
But as a dominant genre.
Like Chinatown.
That's right, Chinatown, exactly.
Did he mention
yes,
that?
He did. He mentioned Chinatown.
Yeah.
And film noir is characterized by the presentation of things fundamentally out of whack, shadowy, foggy, exaggerated, heightened anxiety.
Alfred Hitchcock.
Yes.
Vertigo.
Yeah.
They say that Vertigo was Alfred Hitchcock's autobiography.
Really?
It explains his compulsive attraction to ice blondes and his own fear story, which is of heights, and being, must have been obliterated in some love, fatal love attraction to some blonde murderess. That was Kim Novak in that movie. She just about killed him. Remember the movie?
Yes.
He was going to be thrown from a great height to his death by this drop-dead, ice-cold, blonde person.
Oh, there's a family story in it somewhere.
I just read this yesterday, that it was his story, that was autobiographical. The other ones, and the other ones are much lighter than Vertigo. Rear Window is very spooky.
Yeah.
But the love story is sunny.
Yeah.
And that's true of a number of the others, but Vertigo is the one where it ends and she's going to murder him.
Right. Right. In the tower.
In the tower, bell tower.
Right.
Church. He was probably left at the altar. Anyway, go on.
Well, so Richard then connects this to his study of law. And he says that life has its dark side, and we have a tendency to put on the light side. And he regards this tendency as a turning from the truth. It's a tendency not to seek the truth. You can see what he's saying. It's a tendency to seek the light side of the truth, the rationalization, and to deny the dark side.
In other words, it's a partial view. You can't the whole view of any situation has to include the irrational as well as the rational, and the dark as well as the light. And if you take the view that this is a purely logical situation in which we can merrily romp through the logical steps and come up with a good result, we will be denying half of the universe.
Yes, and I think what he's actually doing is he's making a plea for depth. He's not, as you listen to Richard, you hear him saying, I am not ultimately committed to the dark side. I agree with the commitment to the light side. I too am in pursuit of resolution and clarity.
But it's as if you're a parent, which is what he's referring to. If you want to teach anyone anything, and your child anything, you have to show them what is real. You may choose to go for the good and strive toward the light, but you cannot deny the other stuff. Because if you deny it, you're creating schizophrenia. You're not creating good resolution.
Exactly right. If you think that the way to attain clarity and resolution is to deny the existence of the dark side, then you are headed down the dark hole.
You're creating insanity.
That's correct.
And that is how kids become schizophrenic.
And
because their parents don't allow them to see the downside of anything. Their parents pretend there is none. Your mother, with her wonderful, everything is great if the appearances are great, threatened her children with insanity.
Correct.
And she produced one fairly insane child who also believes that if it looks all right, it probably is. And she produced one half insane child who tells other people, if you want it to be all right, make it look all right. You'll grow into it. Something I disagree with, and so does Richard.
And so Richard's basic message, I think, is embrace the dark side.
Absolutely.
It's not to be feared.
Absolutely.
It's not to be. At least it's a fear to go through and not away from. That
absolutely.
You need to fight the fear rather than flee from it.
Well, now, do you see how this relates to what we were talking about yesterday?
That's why I've been so anxious to talk about it with you.
But here's what I want to say about it. When we were sitting in the car, and I said, I am panicked.
what can I do about it? Now, we now find out that what we had to do about it was you had to look at yourself and what was going on. But when I said, I am panicked, what can I do about it? You said, act as if you're not panicked and it will get better. And I said, I can't do that. Now, that is, sounds to me like I'm joining in with Richard in this. I don't believe that you can act as if it's not there. And I don't think it helps. I think your cartoon with, you know, this is my depressed stance, and if you hold your head up, you stop being depressed, is funny. And it's true only if you've already solved what's causing you to be depressed. Or I should say, but it's true only if you've already solved what's causing you to be depressed. And I think you should strive to eradicate your mother wherever her craziness pops up, and that is one way in which it pops up. If you want to be a success, it's not true that you should act like a success first. Fake it for a while until you get used to it.
You heard, first have to figure out what it is to be a success.
Absolutely.
That's absolutely right. That is the first step in the model, is to figure out what the model of success is.
Absolutely.
That's absolutely right.
And
that's not appearance. That is substance all the way.
You have to go for the substance, and you have to look at what you're capable of and what you're not capable of, and then you have to work out what you're not capable of, and then you go for it.
That's exactly right. That I've experienced that palpably. I get into these. Well, that was the story at
the airport.
That's right, at the airport.
Making the model of your success.
That was it. At Chewton Glen.
I know.
For Granada, I knew what the model of success was substantively. And in the middle of executing, I came into contact with the dark side. I felt my fear starting to overwhelm me. But because I knew what success was, I could deal with the fears in an operational way by paying attention to the division, the possible division between inside and out. So I could feel the fear on the inside, but act on the outside.
Yes, but that's not denying that there's a
that's
fear.
Not denying.
If you were to act as if you had no fear, by trying to convince yourself that you didn't.
That's correct.
Forget it.
And but by going with the fear on the inside, but having a strategy to fight the fear by acting on the outside, and then seeing that the action on the outside is effective.
Right.
I get the reward that gives me the assurance to put the fear behind
it. But now you see why I keep saying to you, I don't buy it, just act as if you're not panicked.
You're absolutely right. I do see it. Without the substantive model of success, the action is a facade.
Not only is it a facade, it makes you worse.
It makes you worse because it denies you the inquiry that's required to find out what the true model of success is.
And if I had said, okay, I'm going to act not panicked, not only would it have and had been successful at it, which I wasn't. That's what I tried all weekend, and I wasn't successful at it. But assume I had been successful, not only would it have let me off the hook, but it would have let you off the hook, and you never would have had to face what was making me panicked.
Absolutely right. Absolutely.
So we'd be two steps behind.
All right, so let me continue.
So Richard's father is your mother.
Richard says that his study has been of constitutional argument. What he's curious about is what persuades in constitutional argument.
Right.
And the point at which he directs his inquiry is the situation in which reason itself doesn't carry you through to a deductive conclusion. That is where you have been persuaded by something, but you can't quite put your finger on what it is that's persuaded you. In other words,
yes, you told
me
that
before.
Okay. But then what troubles me about that is you say that he went on to discuss a bunch of people's opinions, in which most everybody seemed to agree that, yes, these were cases in which something was persuasive other than strict logic. But the ones that he said were persuasive, appealing to the dark side, were ones that people didn't seem to think so were. And the ones he said were persuasive, appealing to the light, It didn't seem so.
Well, let's just go through. He says that the dominant approach is one of reasoning to results. And so the discussion is a discussion in terms of sources and methods. The idea is, what are the appropriate sources and the appropriate methods to allow reasoning through to results?
This stuff doesn't interest me. Go on.
And how do they fit together?
Right.
And so you get a debate about clarity and coherence of constitutional argument. And this approach has run into trouble, because, and that's what critical legal studies has been basically focused on, that as you press on the coherence and clarity of any particular argument, you can find the points where they're not coherent. Things are not, nobody has got a unified theory yet. And so if you press hard enough on any proposition of coherence, you will find the point at which it ceases to be coherent. Right? And that's basically what critical legal studies has been doing, is exploding the myth of coherence.
Absolutely right, except that they have their own myths of coherence.
Uh-huh. Okay. And so Richard describes the critical school as attacking the dark side, as showing the dark side. And that is exactly what they've been doing. They have been showing that, in fact, the side of emotion and fear drives these opinions, and that the logical, unemotional reason coherence is, in fact, a facade. And he said, lots of people have been doing that. I think it's very worthwhile work to do. As I'm listening to Richard, I'm sort of thinking of Edwin Hubble doing his cosmology of identifying and mapping the stars. You know, it's not, he's not a theoretical physicist, although he turns out, in fact, he gets somewhere with it, but he's not your theoretical physicist in the classic world. He's not Einstein. And Richard says...
You're right, since no one knows about him and everyone knows about Einstein.
Richard says he wants to do something different, and he has been doing something different. But he started his study by trying to relate all of constitutional argument to two concepts of democracy. A liberal vision of democracy. Anyway, he goes through his visions of democracy and says, that's what I was doing in the 80s, and I did that. And then I started getting sick of my own dualities there, and I went to another level. Then he said he came to be worried about getting too happy. He got too happy with his own dichotomous way of looking at things. And he thought he could only get a true sense of the vision by relating to the fears. And then he asks, now what is the emotional experience of being moved by constitutional argument? And he says, in exploring that, it's clear to me it has to do with rhetoric. And so I was led to pay attention to how I was moved by all forms of argument. Movies, spy stories, everything. How do they move us? And he came to see that the movement for him was best explained in terms of this dichotomy of dark and light. That somehow they mesh, and in the ways that they mesh, he thinks he can find the answers. So he says, I find that I'm moved by fitting endings. I'm moved when things fit together, when they come together, when something becomes clear that has been unclear. We become comfortable. We rest, repose. We have a sense of control and trust. And that in its way, it's a form of wish fulfillment. But he says the dark side also moves us. When we're exposed to the dark side, we're often moved by things that make us uncomfortable and threatened and anxious, that they create a tension, and the tension is in some sense created by an argument that we don't fully understand, and so we press on it. And he then argues that the wish fulfillment, the sense of resolution, is driven by the anxiety, that resolution moves us more when the tension has been created. So that without the dark side, you don't get the light, that the one is relative to the other. That to produce the greatest resolution, you need the greatest tension. And he then asserts
That's true in sex. Yes,
absolutely. He then says, you can be moved without resolution, but what you're moved to is a sense of existential vigilance. And as Richard says it, you know that he's making a personal statement of what he feels. Richard is saying, I feel that I am a person who exists in a state of existential vigilance, and I am proud of it. And I, in other words, I have been moved by the dark side. And it is movement.
Me too.
And then he goes through...
Wait.
Yeah.
It's too much of what he goes through.
Okay. So, yeah, react to that, and then we'll close this one off for a while, and we'll come back to it later on. There's more, and it's wonderful.
I feel that it's a little bit too amorphous for me to react to, and that I don't really want to get into the details, because the details have to do with legal reasoning, in a way.
It's rhetoric. It's persuasion.
Well,
there's nothing legal in that.
I understand that, but the proof of his theory, he would cite legal examples, if you see what I'm saying. How was I persuaded
for
by Holmes?
That's right. For confirmation of his hypothesis,
that's
he will
right.
go to legal argumentation.
Right, and I don't want to hear that. But he's onto something. What I think that he's onto, aside from the... No, it can't be aside from, is the general issue of how you resolve disputes with anybody.
Right.
Okay. But that's all I can say. I'm just such a